You have to excuse me if I'm a little sparse on the details here, as the findings of this particular case pose a very real threat to my life. You see, after 10 years of working for the police department, I decided to go private. Better pay, better hours, and considerably less dangerous. Or so I thought, anyway. Because being a PI got me involved in a case where there was much, much more going on than the police reports would lead you to believe, and the course of the investigation changed my life forever. A teenage girl is working the closing shift in a shoe store located in a large strip mall. The only two people left on site at closing time are her and the store's security guard. The security guard attested that he witnessed her locking every door except one, the front door, and he only left as she was moments away from shuttering up and locking it. But cameras showed that she never emerged to either shutter or lock the door. The security guard grabs a bite to eat from a fast food joint located in the same strip mall, but on his way out of the lot in his car, he notices the lights are still on in the shoe store. He parks up, walks back to check on her, then finds the girl lying in a pool of blood in the store stockroom. He calls 911, EMTs and the cops show up, then not long after, the girl's parents show up too. They were so worried about her being late home from work that they drove over to see if everything was okay. Needless to say, it wasn't. I can't even imagine how painful that must have been, the moment they turned the corner only to see blue and red flashing lights. It's every parent's worst nightmare, and it couldn't have happened to nicer people. And I should know, because I was in touch with those poor folks almost every day for the better part of a year. The girl was just about to go off to college, too. Everyone was so excited. So, for some evil monster to rob them of that joy is just unforgivable. Despite not being anywhere near the store at the time of the girl's death, the security guard was questioned numerous times by local police, but there was absolutely no real evidence connecting him to the crime. That didn't stop the cops from trying to build a case against the guy, though, and they tried all kinds of verbal and procedural traps to try to get this guy to slip up and incriminate himself. Which brings me to my first interesting observation. Because the strip mall served several rural communities for a very large tri-county area, and some idiot had the idea to build it right where all three intersect. What's more, it's so large that it literally straddles the boundaries of all three counties, which should have made the girl's murder something of a jurisdictional nightmare. From experience, homicide detectives would throttle their own mothers and voluntarily take on a tough case like that. But here steps up one county sheriff, who starts waxing lyrical on how, by golly, I will not let such a senseless murder go unpunished. This will be the very definition of swift justice. The public applauded such selfless, courageous, and righteous policing, and the other departments were only too happy to let their neighboring counterpart take a bite of that convoluted sandwich. It was assumed that this sheriff had a guy he liked for the murder. Otherwise, why would you take it? Only, he didn't get it solved. In fact, it got thrown onto the cold case pile less than a year afterwards, and it didn't make sense to me why the department would be happy to take the hit like that. So, I started digging. 6 months after the girl's murder, the vast amount of publicity surrounding the case had died down somewhat. There had been numerous appeals for information, sizable crowdfunded awards were offered, and the family had even set up an anonymous free phone number. But as time went by, the tips dried up, and the investigation in general began to flounder. People just kinda moved on. That's when the cassette tape arrived. One morning, the girl's dad goes out to his mailbox to find a small package in there. Instead is one of those old analog cassette tapes, and the label just says, "Play me." Dad takes the tape inside, puts it into his stereo, and presses play. Driving up on the scene of your own daughter's murder must have been hard enough on him, but I can't imagine the grief, the rage, the utter despair he must have felt upon listening to that tape. It was a recording made by a man who claimed to be his daughter's murderer, and it's one of the single most disturbing pieces of audio I've ever heard in all my years in law enforcement or private investigation. I won't go into details for my sake and yours, but let's just say the general theme was how good it felt to take her life. How good it felt knowing he was going to get away with it. How the father had the presence of mind to just stop the tape and call the cops without smashing the stereo into bits, I don't know. But he knew the best chance of catching that guy was to get the tape to the cops in one piece. Only trouble was, of all the messed up things the guy said on the tape, it was all centered around info that had already been released to the public. That, and the tape had apparently been mailed from the complete opposite side of the state, which conflicted with the cops' idea that the murderer was local, as they must have been casing the place to catch the shoe store employee alone. As a result, the sheriff called the tape out as a hoax, nothing more than a disgustingly cruel prank by some kid with too much time on their hands. He actually went on local TV to call the guy out personally, telling him that if he really was the killer, he'd give them some shred of info that wasn't already out there in the public sphere. Sure enough, no more tapes were mailed, so to them, it was conclusive. The tape was a hoax and was to be discounted as evidence. Another half a year went by, and by that time, the investigation had completely ground to a halt. As a result, it was tossed on the cold cases pile, and it looked like the girl's parents were unlikely to get the justice they deserved. And that's where I step onto the stage. I was hired by the girl's family to look into the murder, essentially picking up on the investigation where the local sheriffs had left off. I warned them that it wouldn't be an easy job, and that if I hadn't found anything 3 months into the job, they were to take me off retainer. I got bills to pay like the rest of you, and I just don't want to milk grieving families to do it, you know. My first move was to get in touch with the small town sheriff's department who were in charge of the initial investigation. Thankfully, they were only too happy to intermediate with a PI, especially one with prior law enforcement experience, and they promised me full access to the case file and all corresponding evidence. They were still as keen to crack the case as ever, it was just budgeting restrictions which kept them from keeping a man on it full time. The way they explained it, if I were to find anything that'd give them good reason to reopen the case, I'd be something of a local hero. But for people who talked a big game about wanting to solve the case, they certainly weren't falling over themselves to actually help me. First, it was the slow responses. I'd have to wait days to hear back from them. Everything moved at a snail's pace. Then there was getting access to the evidence archives. Everybody had to ask everybody else if they'd seen the key, and getting the right permission forms for a civilian was almost impossible. There was only so much, "I'm just snowed under right now," or "sorry, I thought someone saw to that for you," I could take before I started to get a little suspicious, you know. But in the end, to their credit, they granted me access to the evidence and most importantly, that cassette tape that had been sent to the father. I was repeatedly warned that it was nothing more than a red herring, that all I was going to do was give myself the heebie-jeebies by listening to it. And while the latter was certainly true, the tape itself had proved to be anything but irrelevant. Let me just preface by saying that the recording itself was just as disturbing, if not more so, than I first imagined it would be. Whoever had made the recording had gone to some length to disguise their voice, so it was impossible to tell exactly how old they might be. But something about the vocabulary of the person was highly reminiscent of my college-age nephew. From what I could gather, the cops had focused almost exclusively on the security guard and a handful of people who just so happened to have been in the parking lot at the time the store closed. Almost none of the girl's friends or peers had been questioned in relation to her death, and considering that the majority of murder victims are killed by someone they know, that just didn't add up for me. On top of that, what the cops said about the caller not providing much detail, that proved not to strictly be the case. They were extremely detailed regarding what they'd done to the body, as well as the position it was left in. Both details matched up to the police reports, and as far as I know, no police department in America releases the explicitly gory details of any individual murder. Leaks happen, sure, but still, it's what I call a bug bite detail. The more I scratched at it, the more inflamed it got, until there was just no ignoring it anymore. The tape had much more significance than people had been led to believe, and the cops had lied about it. The only question was, why? After that little revelation, I focused a great deal of my time into investigating the cassette tape and its origins. The cops knew where it had been sent from, and that was a large college town in the next state over. I totally get why they might consider it was probably a hoax, based on the fact that only around 10% of the high school graduates end up going to that particular college. But to rule it out entirely seemed like pure ignorance to me. But again, another piece seemed to fall into place when I talked to the victim's parents and discovered that the victim was due to attend that exact same college. That's the point where I was convinced the killer was someone that was known to the victim. There were already indicators, such as the fact that there was no sign of a struggle at the scene of the crime, but by that point it seemed concrete. Next came the hard part, comparing a tri-county list of all the high school graduates of the victim's age group that had gotten a place at this particular college. It involved calling around 7 different high schools to convince 7 different principals to share some fairly intimate information with a total stranger. And let me assure you, that was no small feat. I was looking at a week or two's worth of waiting before I got all that info together. So in the meantime, I thought I'd get in touch with the county sheriff who had been in charge of the investigation to see which of the victim's peer group they'd done interviews with. By that time, me and the sheriff had been in touch every couple of days for maybe 3 to 4 months. I'd gone so far as to say we had a good professional relationship, so much so that I even had his home phone number. So, I give him a call at home one Saturday morning. The call gets answered, but instead of the sheriff, I hear a different, weirdly familiar voice on the other end. It was a young man's voice, late teens or early 20s. From his name and age, I figured it was the sheriff's eldest son, so I asked him to put his dad on the phone. We talked briefly about the handful of the victim's friends that were interviewed, and the sheriff assured me he'd have the transcripts released. Business was concluded, and we hung up. I drive over to the department HQ the next day to pick up the interview transcripts, only to find there's literally nothing of note in them. All they seemed to have asked was, "How are you holding up?" And the same phrase cropped up in all the 3 statements. They were shocked and confused by their close friend's sudden and brutal murder. None of the obviously important questions seemed to have been asked, like if the victim had made anyone mad in the days or weeks prior, if she'd had any kind of stalker, or if she was romantically involved with anyone. Those are all the first questions I'd have been asking, and the sheriff himself had completely neglected to ask them during interviews he himself had conducted. Either that's the most flagrant case of police negligence I'd ever personally encountered, or something extremely worrying was going on. About a week after, I had my complete list of all the kids in the Tri-County area, and with it, I'm convinced that one of the 13 names I got was our victim's killer. It just didn't make any sense why the sheriff and his deputies would neglect such a line of inquiry, no matter how improbable it seemed. But then, I saw a name on that list that was instantly familiar to me, and it was the name of the sheriff's eldest son, the very same kid who had answered the phone to me that Saturday morning. It was then I understood why his voice had seemed so familiar. It wasn't because I'd heard it in passing, maybe in the background of one of our many phone calls. It was because it was the voice on the cassette tape. Then all of a sudden everything fell into place. This small country sheriff's department wasn't incompetent. Quite the opposite, actually. They successfully covered up a murder that had been committed by their sheriff's own kid. This put me in a very precarious situation. And to me, there was only one member of the department that I thought I could really genuinely trust. So, foolishly, I called them and asked them if there was any possibility of the sheriff's son being considered as a suspect in the shoe store employee's murder. Naturally, she just responds with something along the lines of,
"I'm sorry, you think we should consider,
name redacted,
as a suspect in a murder case? You know that sheriff,
redacted,
his kid, right? He's on a,
redacted,
scholarship over at,
redacted.
If there's any truth to this, we're looking at a huge scandal here. Are you sure you're willing to make a case for this?
And I was. I really was. And I don't believe for a second that my friend in the department was in on it. I believed them when they said that they wanted to help me take the case to the FBI, but I guess I was foolish for thinking that word wouldn't get out somehow. Because a few days after, I get a call from an unknown number. It was the sheriff, and he wanted to talk in person. And here's the part where I have to let you all down. If this was a movie, I'd have gone to the meeting, maybe strapped a wire to myself, or coordinated with super sleek FBI agents to entrap the bad guy and bring him down. But I think we all know that going to meet that sheriff alone, having uncovered what I had, that would have amounted to me taking my own life, essentially. As far as I could tell, this was a conspiracy that ran deeper than I ever could have anticipated, and I'm not ashamed to say that I was scared for my life. The sheriff might well have used a burner phone to arrange the meeting, thus removing himself from the freak murder that would no doubt befall me upon arrival. I appreciate that might sound paranoid, but you should have heard the way this guy talked to me. Like I said already, we'd been buddy-buddy for months by that point, but the way he spoke to me was like I was Judas Iscariot himself. The same night I skipped the meeting, he called again, politely and cryptically reminding me that we both knew a great deal about each other's families, and that it would be a sure shame if anything happened to either of them. And I don't think I need to spell out what that meant. Within 6 months, I had moved my wife and kid out to the other side of the country, dissolved my company that I'd been running at the time, and set up an entirely new one to throw off any pursuers. It was tough reestablishing myself in a brand new place, especially where none of the cops knew me as one of their own. But I really didn't have much choice, did I? And please don't suggest I could have arranged a bunch of evidence packages to be mailed off in the event of my untimely demise. Like I said, life just isn't like the movies in so many different ways. And that's the bottom line. The shoe store victim's parents will never find out what happened to their daughter. And if that's the price I have to pay to keep my kids safe, to keep my wife safe, as cowardly as it is, I'm more than willing to pay it. I've been a private investigator for 11 years now, and in that time, I've worked some absolute doozies. Most of my work involves cheating spouses, and although that brings in the lion's share of the cash, it can get very depressing. One woman hired me 3 times, and each time her husband was having an affair with the same woman after swearing that he'd stop. The 4th time she tried to hire me, I refused. Told her to stop doing that to herself and to move on with her life. But every so often I get a case that actually makes me feel like I'm part of the force again, for all the good and bad that comes with it. And this one I'm about to tell you involves the apparent taking of one's life of a promising young man whose parents just couldn't accept the version of the truth they'd been given. As the story went, this kid had everything going for him. He was looking at attending an Ivy League school. He played all-state lacrosse. He was an experienced rock climber. He had a bunch of loyal friends, and he had a girlfriend who, by all accounts, he loved dearly. But one night, he and this girlfriend had a vicious argument at a party. The friends disagreed on exactly what it was, but in the heat of the moment, they broke up. From what I can gather, a lot of alcohol was involved that night, which only exacerbated emotions that were already running high. The kid walks downtown to the huge Catholic cathedral, one which had a skeleton of scaffolding outside it, as one of the facades was being renovated. Here, he was apparently so overcome with grief that he climbs to the very top of the scaffold and throws himself to his death. This might sound callous, but it wouldn't be anything I hadn't seen 100 times before. Someone taking their own life is now the biggest killer of men under 30, and you usually talk to friends and family who say things like, he was battling with depression, he tried once before, stuff that just confirms the prognosis. But in this case, not a single soul I spoke to ever mentioned anything about the kid being like that or being in that type of headspace.
In fact, more than brought up an apparent love triangle involving the kid, his ex-girlfriend, and a rival of his, than mentioned any history of depression or self-harm. And it's then that I find the investigations really heat up. Both the kid and his rival are both sighted at the same party on the night of his death. The kid and his ex-girlfriend have their argument just after midnight, and the kid is seen leaving the party at around 1 a.m. Coincidentally, several witnesses confirm that the rival is nowhere to be seen after the 1 a.m. mark. I track down this rival, sell him some story about a car thief being active in the area on the night in question, and how it's my job to rule him out as the thief. I lie to him because I want to see if he has an alibi for his whereabouts after 1 a.m., and I don't want to spook him by mentioning what my actual theory was, that the kid was murdered by this rival, possibly out of anger, possibly out of jealousy. And what do you know? This rival kid's alibi is weaker than 50 cent beer, and I'm 90% certain that he's lying to me in some capacity. But how do you say that to family? Oh, by the way, I know you're upset about the death of your child, but good news, it might have actually been a murder. Well, the answer is, you don't. You keep all that stuff to yourself until you can present a full and conclusive case for it. I immediately get to work researching the relationship between the kid, the rival, and all their mutual friends. What I tend to find is that people are willing to tell me things that they're not willing to tell regular police officers, but they're still not entirely forthcoming. This is where social media comes in. If some intelligence agency genius was tasked with inventing something by which a country's population would voluntarily give away intimate details about themselves, they would have invented Facebook. You honestly used to be able to just bring up Facebook, whether or not you even had an account, then explore people's profiles. You could know where they'd been, who with, who they knew, who their family is, but not anymore. Emphasis on privacy measures means that private eyes like me have to think a little more outside the box when it comes to gathering information on social media. As it turns out, you don't need to hack an account or create a fake catfish profile to get a person to accept your friend request, although that works 9 out of 10 times, especially with men. All you need to do is get all buddy-buddy with one of the Facebook administrators, and no one makes you friends faster than good old Benjamin Franklin. Now, I'm not about to give up my sources here. I know for a fact that not only would the person be fired, but Facebook would sue them into the ground for breach of contract. But since I pay handsomely to view my subjects' profiles, I can get considerably more info than my competitors, and in a marketplace as cutthroat as this one, that can make the world of difference. So I drive over to my contact's place, hop onto his computer, and start browsing. That's how I find out that my case had a very unusual hobby, one that was shared by a number of his friends too. They were what's known as urban free climbers, and just in case you're wondering, that's exactly what it sounds like. A group will pick out something tall, climbable, but very intimidating, and they'll climb it, but not without a visual record of their achievements. Only urban free climbing isn't exactly legal, and posting videos of yourself committing serial trespass and arguably criminal damage in some cases definitely isn't smart. So, slowly but surely, I start unearthing private Facebook groups and encrypted combos, all which detail the kid's penchant for climbing great heights with absolutely nothing in the way of safety equipment. From what I could tell, he and his friends were pretty good at it too. But I also discovered something about the cathedral that pretty much closed the case. The scaffold this kid would have used took him all the way up to the roof of the basilica, and fortunately, the cathedral allowed me access to the stairwells which led to the roof. I say the roof, but it turned out to be nothing more than an 18th century sandstone maintenance hatch. If I wanted to get actual photographic evidence of the area the kid had climbed up to, I'd have to do a little climbing of my own. It wasn't all that hard. Being up so high was absolutely terrifying, and I made the mistake of ignoring the old advice of don't look down. But the ledge I was on was maybe 10 feet wide. All I had to do was circle around a little, and I'd be able to see where the kid climbed to. That's when I see these patches of copper cladding. Copper cladding that would have been extremely slippery if they happened to be damp. All I had to do was cross-reference that little detail with multiple witness statements saying it had rained on the night of the party, and I had my case.
Closing cases like that are always emotional affairs. It's nice to be able to give the family the good news. It just hurts when the good news is, oh, your son's death was just an accident, not him taking his own life. So he's still gone. He just died drunk, not miserable. To me, it was conclusive. He tried to climb away his romantic frustrations, not considering that some of his grips would be wet and slippery. Heartbreaking, yes, but nothing darker than a tragic accident. When I told the family of my findings, they acted like I'd announced he was alive again or something. His mother was so happy to hear it hadn't been what she thought it was. I guess that was all the closure she was ever hoping to get. And knowing I helped to give her that put a bit of a lump in my throat as I was saying goodbye. There's just one aspect of this case that doesn't sit well with me. From what I could gather, the whole idea that the urban climber kid had taken his own life as a result of the breakup, it seemed to have been started by one or two of his friend's circle just to put his ex-girlfriend down. They had absolutely no evidence of it. They simply sought to blame her for his death, to scapegoat her as the catalyst when her involvement was purely coincidental. These rumors became concrete, even made their way into police reports, and as a result, she suffered from a crippling guilt-based depression. I'm not sure if she ever made it to college, but I know the kid's death and the backlash that followed meant her SATs were essentially sabotaged. That's what scared me the most about this particular case. More than the possibility of murder, more than climbing onto the exterior of that cathedral's dome, it's how willing people are to victimize each other, to turn each other into what amounts to human sacrifices. Someone has to take the blame, blood for blood. To me, we're still just frightened pilgrims, hanging witches in 17th century Salem. And that scares me more than anything. The scariest case I ever took on was when a woman in her 40s gives me a ring, tells me she reckons her husband is having it away with a bit on the side. Those kind of jobs are my bread and butter. So off I pop following this bloke round, trying to catch him out with his bit of crumpet while the wife's at home bathing the kids or something. About a week goes by, and no matter how much I follow this bloke around, he never seems to do anything too dodgy or go anywhere remotely naughty. I'm actually getting a bit frustrated when one afternoon, after he finished work, he starts driving out in the middle of bloody nowhere. I think I've got him, don't I? His one bit of unusual behavior, traveling out of town. It's gotta be it. Only he doesn't go to some bloody travel lodge or anything. He goes right out to the beach, into this little boathouse hidden among some sand dunes. I'm thinking, what kind of bloke meets his bit of skirt in a place like this? But either way, I grab my camera and start sneaking down towards the shack to get a picture or two of the action. I'm right up on the door, edging it open, getting ready to snap a shot of this fellow's pale, hairy bottom going up and down like the clappers, when I feel something cold and metallic pushing into the back of my head. You the police? If I'd have said yeah, there's no doubt in my mind now that my brains would be splattered all over the inside of that boathouse, because what felt like a piece of pipe was actually a single-barrel 12-gauge, proper old farmer's blunderbuss it was. No, I'm not. I'm a private eye. Your missus thinks you're shagging about. There was silence for a moment. Then he pokes me in the back of the head with the barrel, so hard it hurts, and says, "Get in that shack." I go in, and see there's all these black plastic packages in the hull of a small rowing boat. Drugs, had to be. Only reason he'd be willing to kill a copper. That big boy money, so to speak. This fella held me at gunpoint, made me strip, went through all of my stuff making sure I was who I said I was. He was only satisfied when he saw my business card. He asked me again why I'm following him, and I tell him honestly, "Mrs. reckons you're shagging about." Good God, my voice was quaking like you wouldn't believe, thinking you're going to get slaughtered like that. It really puts things into perspective. For the first time, he takes the gun off me, laughing to himself, then says, "Here's what's going to happen. You're going to take $5,000 off me,
go back to my missus, and tell her I'm not having an affair. Tell her I take long walks on the beach. Tell her I'm going bird watching. Just don't tell her the truth. You got it?
He kept one of my business cards to let me know he was deadly serious. Any messing about, then there's blokes I work with that'll come and find you. And again, I know he was deadly serious. Needless to say, getting paid twice for one job was great stuff. But thinking I was about to get my head blown off by a secret drug dealer in a beachside boating hut, can't say I'd recommend it, to be honest.
On a breezy February morning in the Florida Everglades, back in 2005, a local power company worker was driving by the empty lots of an unbuilt cul-de-sac when he spotted something which took his breath away. Face down in a clump of weeds just off the side of the road was the bruised and battered body of a blonde Caucasian female in her early 20s. When this power company employee made the 911 call that alerted the authorities to the body, he told them he hadn't checked for any vital signs as he was almost sure the girl was dead. But upon the arrival of EMTs, they made a shocking discovery. Despite being beaten to within an inch of her life, carnally violated, and then left as a snack for the gators, the girl was found to be still alive. She was rushed to the Jackson Memorial Hospital in Miami with severe head trauma and a number of broken bones, including those of her orbital socket. When she awoke, she was terrified and confused, but irrefutably lucky to be alive. Doctors then asked her if she had any memory of the events that preceded her arrival at the ER, and this is when they discovered that the girl was in fact a Ukrainian immigrant, one with an apparently patchy grasp of English. However, the girl did know one particular English word very well, and it's certainly not one you'd expect someone to say after almost losing their life. "Lawyer," the girl kept saying. "Give me a lawyer." Right away, the girl's unusual request marked hers out as a very unusual case. Miami police discovered that she had been living at the Airport Regency Hotel for the previous few months after receiving a nasty injury during her job working on a cruise ship. The company that owned the ship was nice enough to pay for the hotel room she'd been staying, and it's the same fourth floor hotel room in which the vicious assault was said to have commenced. Through a translator, police heard the woman describe her attackers as two or three white men who spoke with accents, but when asked what kind of accents, she said she wasn't sure. However, she did remember one of the men pushing a pillow into her face before forcing her to drink something which had a very strong taste to it. It could have been alcohol, she said, but it was clear there could have been anything mixed into the concoction that was clearly meant to incapacitate her. What came next was like something out of a nightmare, she said. She had fractured, puzzle-piece memories of being carried out of the hotel, thrown into the back seat of a car, and then made to beg for her life as her captors took turns inflicting some of the obscenest acts imaginable upon her. When they were done, they simply dragged her out of the car and tossed her into the same patch of weeds she was found in, just a few miles down the road from her hotel. It was a horrific story, but it gave the cops absolutely nothing to go on in terms of suspects or evidence. The only hope had been in the DNA recovered from under the girl's fingernails, scraps of skin she raked off whilst trying to defend herself. Samples were sent off to a lab, but no matches came back. Yet soon after, it became clear why the girl had been so quick to request a lawyer. This lawyer was so quick to file a negligence lawsuit against the Regency Hotel Group that the whole thing almost seemed oddly pre-planned. There was no denying that the girl's wounds were real. There was no doubt she'd suffered a harrowing and sadistic attack. But could it be part of some larger, sinisterly sophisticated scam? She was a clear and obvious victim, but was she also some kind of puppet? Miami-Dade detectives did the best they could with the scant evidence available, and predictably, they came up with very little. The hotel had almost 200 rooms, and so many people came and went that it would have taken months working full-time to run checks on every one of them, something that would have stretched a police department, especially one in a high-crime area like Miami-Dade, to its very limits.
After just shy of 2 months on the job, the detective handling the case was forced to throw in the towel, so the case was automatically transferred to a civil court. If the woman's case was successful, the hotel chain would be forced to pay out tens of millions of dollars, a move they were naturally adverse to. So, in response, the company hired a private detective to get to the bottom of what really happened that night, and whether or not it was connected to wider events. Enter Ken Brennan. To some, Ken seemed like a character from a bad Hollywood cop movie that had just up and walked out of the screen. Having spent the majority of his career in his native Long Island as a DEA agent, Ken's move down to Florida to work as a private investigator had him fully embracing the Magnum PI stereotype. With his deep tan, weightlifter's physique, and shock of white-gray hair, Ken finished off the look with flamboyant open-neck shirts and garish gold chains. And the man's attitude proved that as much as you can take a person out of Long Island, you could never take the Long Island out of a person. By all accounts, Ken is a loud, brash, and straight-talking New Yorker, but he's also one of the warmest, friendliest people you're ever likely to meet. It's obvious how passionate he is about his work, and it all stems from his love of his fellow man. He was bona fide hardcore with a heart of gold, and he always found out the truth. Besides, this was a job that genuinely interested him. This was Ken's secret. He only ever took jobs that lit a fire in him. That way, he never failed to deliver on the facts. The only question was if this was a tragic but isolated attack, or if the girl was the puppet of some kind of Eastern European crime syndicate. After touching base with the Miami-Dade Police Department, Ken began to understand why they were having such difficulty with the case. The victim's statement had actually been revised a number of times, which muddied the investigative waters even further. First off, she'd mentioned that her attackers may have had Hispanic accents, but later rectified that to saying they spoke with Romanian accents. She also mentioned there being three men at first, but then later said there may have only been two. However, when pushed by detectives, she admitted it was entirely possible that there may have only been one attacker. Naturally, that kind of statement made for a difficult investigation, yet there was one big hope for Ken and the police department: the hotel's security system. Being part of a wealthy, multinational hotel corporation meant the Airport Regency Hotel had a highly advanced security system. The property was fenced and the back gates were locked and monitored. There were only a few points of entry and exit, and during the night, the back door was locked and could be opened only remotely. On top of that, the premises was covered by two patrolling security guards and a legion of high-definition security cameras. And with every hotel guest and staff member having their own unique digital keycard, it would be possible to track the coming and goings of every person who checked in. The only issue was the amount of work it would take, but it was a task that Ken Brennan was just about crazy enough to undertake. Ken knew that the victim had arrived at her hotel room at 3:14 a.m. on the night of the attack, using her keycard to enter her room. At some point over the next 3 hours, some kind of violent incident took place which ended with her lying in the weeds by that Everglades cul-de-sac. But bizarrely, there was absolutely no evidence of the attack on any of the hotel's legion of cameras. Ken approached the hotel and inquired about the condition of their surveillance equipment, but found everything to be in working order. What's more, they were some of the most high-tech pieces of CCTV equipment he'd ever laid eyes on, so the problem certainly wasn't with the system. It was then that Ken was forced to consider the possibility that the victim had actually climbed out of her window somehow, possibly as a way to escape her pursuer, or that maybe her captors had somehow lowered her unconscious body to the ground below. But this seemed like far too elaborate and dangerous a plan, considering her room was on the fourth floor. The only other logical explanation was that the woman had worn some kind of disguise to exit the hotel undetected. So, willing to exhaust every possible explanation, Ken began studying the security footage for anyone with similar dimensions to the victim. Again, no luck. It was proving to be one of the most confounding mysteries of his entire career, and in the end, the solution would be just as disturbing. Of all the people present at the hotel around 3:41 a.m., Ken began to pay attention to one particular individual.
He was at least 6'4" and had to weigh a minimum of 300 and change. Despite it being almost 4 in the morning, the man was wearing large, dark sunglasses. The man carries a rather large case of luggage to an elevator, where he and a victim seem to exchange a few words before they both travel to the fourth floor. Less than 2 hours later, at around 5:30 a.m., the same large man reappears in the hotel lobby, still dragging that same large piece of luggage behind him. He exits the hotel, returning shortly before dawn without the piece of luggage, where he then reappears to retire for the night. This raised an important question. Why would a man haul his luggage out of an airport hotel in the wee small hours of the morning if he wasn't checking out, only to return to his room without it? Ken watched the man's movements over and over again, trying to be mindful of every little thing that the man did on his way in and out of the hotel. A sly turn of the head, a display of nervous body language. Ken knew just about anything could put him on the trail of the truth. And then, it hit him. As the man steps off of the hotel's elevator, the wheels of his luggage became briefly caught. It's barely even noticeable, but it's there. The guy had to give the luggage quite a forceful pull for it to come unstuck. The victim didn't walk out of the hotel in disguise. She didn't climb out of the hotel room's window. The victim left the airport Regency, crammed into the largest man's luggage. There was simply no other explanation for it. The horrifying realization hit Ken like a bullet between the eyes, but there was something else that scared him too. In his many years in the DEA, Ken had noticed a consistency in the behavior of men who'd been caught in a violent crime. They're hysterical, shaking, panicking. They stick out like a sore thumb on CCTV cameras. Yet here was this guy, cool as a cucumber, like he'd done the exact same thing 100 times before, and he was good at it too. It was most definitely not the first time this perp had done something like this. In fact, he might just be the key to solving hundreds of horrific cold cases all over the state of Florida. Ken tracked the large man to a nearby restaurant following the attack, and it's here that a CCTV camera is close enough to catch a word on the back of his t-shirt. Verado, it said. Ken hammered the word into Google, discovering that Verado was the name of a new outboard engine manufactured by Mercury Marine, the boat engine manufacturer. There had been a big boat show in Miami during early February, the same time of the attack. These shirts had only been given to employees of the boat show's food court, which was run by a company called Centerplate. Brennan called the head of human resources for Centerplate, who told him that the company had indeed booked rooms for its employees at the Regency, but that it had hired more than 200 different temporary employees for the boat show, some of which had come from as far away as Louisiana. Ken asked if any of the employees had been particularly large, and if they'd worn large dark sunglasses. The HR manager told him, yes, there had been someone fitting that description, and that the company had initially hired the man to work at Zephyr Field, home of the minor league baseball team, the New Orleans Zephyrs. It was then that Ken got his biggest breakthrough yet. The HR manager dug up the employee's file, telling Ken that the large man's name was Mike Jones. With the name, Ken could find out exactly when and where the attacker was staying. Michael Lee Jones had checked in on Valentine's Day, just 7 days prior to the attack, and he had checked out on the 22nd of February, one day after he was seen rolling his suitcase to the car. It became clear that Michael had the perfect MO for a serial carnal attacker. His food service job had kept him moving from city to city, all expenses paid, and his method of attack and concealment was horrifyingly effective. Michael no longer worked for Centerplate, but that didn't deter Ken from his hunt. He called every single one of Centerplate's competitors, assuming that Michael had remained in the catering industry. Time after time, he came up short. He'd wait on hold for 20 minutes at a time, only for some HR manager to tell him that no one by the name of Michael Lee Jones worked for their company. Eventually, Ken found himself talking to the COO of a company named Ovations. When asked if there was a 300-pound African-American by the name of Michael Lee Jones working for the company, there was no hesitation in the COO's response. Get a subpoena.
Every other person had been more than willing to help, and had taken the time to do so. But here was this guy telling him to go kick rocks, without so much as skipping a beat. It was then that Ken knew he had the right company, and his response to the COO, "Go get a subpoena? Okay, I will." Within the hour, Ovation's company fax machine roared into life and belched out the relevant paperwork headed with the seal of the Miami-Dade Police Department. The response came back just as fast. Michael Lee Jones was living in Fredericks, Maryland. It was time to swoop in for the kill. Upon being confronted by the police, Mike Jones was more than cooperative. He firmly protested the accusation and welcomed the opportunity to provide a DNA sample which could conclusively prove his innocence. He admitted to sleeping with a German woman whilst down in Miami, but assured both police and Ken Brennan that the encounter had been entirely consensual. Obviously, everyone involved was sure of the man's innocence. After all, who in their right mind provides a DNA sample voluntarily when they know they're guilty? Yet all would become clear in due course. All they had to do was wait for the sample to be tested. A few months later, Ken Brennan got a call from the Miami-Dade Police Department. The DNA had come back a match, not just in the case of the Ukrainian woman, but on three other cases of similar assault. Two of these victims had been in New Orleans. One of them had gone looking for a cab back to her hotel after a night of drinking, when a very large man with glasses pulled his car over to the curb and offered her a ride. He drove her to an empty lot on the outskirts of the city and began the life-changing, traumatizing attack. The victim later said that she bit his palm so hard that she had bits of his skin in her teeth afterwards. When he was finished, he drove off, leaving her on the lot. According to Ken, this is this guy's thing. He got a job that sends him all over the country. He's slick, nonchalant. He's too cool, too calm. He's probably done this 100 times, if not more. Michael Lee Jones is serving what amounts to a life sentence at the Fremont Correctional Facility in Colorado for a series of assaults committed in the Centennial State. Given that he is presently approaching his 50th birthday and his first parole hearing isn't until 2032, it's strongly believed that Michael will die in prison, which for some is exactly the kind of place a man like him deserves to spend his final hours, having relinquished their chances at freedom just to satisfy the depraved, predatory urges. During my time as a private investigator, I've had my fair share of bad cases. The worst case I'd ever taken in my time as a PI had to be the family that hired me to find their missing daughter. They were this cleaned-up Christian couple whose teenage daughter had gone off the rails, started taking drugs, and eventually ran away from home. They gave me a bunch of info on her circle of friends, where she was most likely to be. When I tracked her down, she was in a bad state. But I didn't pass on her whereabouts to her parents, and here's why. She claimed that her parents had been seriously and violently abusing her. And when I call her out on it, she took her phone and showed me video of it. She managed to hide her phone in her room during one instance of it. When I went back to the parents, they laughed it off. I mean, they honestly reacted like it was the most ridiculous thing they'd ever heard of. But I had literally seen them doing it. They were so convincing about it too, like it was one of the most shockingly blatant displays of psychopathy I'd ever seen. Luckily, I convinced the daughter to go to the cops about it. And thankfully, now both the parents are serving lengthy prison sentences. It just sometimes never ceases to amaze me how the most perfectly normal-looking folks have the capacity for pure evil. Hey friends, thanks for listening. Click that notification bell to be alerted of all future narrations. I release new videos every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. And if you got a story, be sure to submit them to my subreddit, r/letsreadofficial, and maybe even hear your story featured on the next video. And if you want to support me even more, grab early access to all future narrations for just $1 a month on Patreon, and maybe even pick up some Let's Read merch on Spreadshirt.com.
and check out the Let's Read podcast, where you can hear all these stories in long compilation form and save huge on data, located anywhere you listen to podcasts. Links down below. Thanks so much, friends, and I'll see you soon.